This is the UCLA Mindful Weekly Lecture. Each week, Diana Winston, or one of our UCLA Mindful teachers, offers a talk about mindfulness to deepen our understanding and cultivate well-being. Thanks for joining us.
Okay, so I know there were a few of you here who were on the retreat I just did, and I was going to share with you at least a portion of a talk that I gave on the retreat. And so it was a 5-day retreat at Big Bear Meditation Center, and it was just wonderful to be able to practice with a bunch of people over a longer period of time and to share the teachings. And so I'm going to talk on something that I talked about then, which is the topic of wisdom and how wisdom is developed. And in particular, I'm going to focus on three different characteristics of that come out of the Buddhist world. Now, I think most of you know that mindfulness is rooted in Buddhism, and you do not have to be a Buddhist to practice mindfulness. And you also may find that mindfulness is not only, it's certainly not like, it's influenced by Buddhism. There's a lot in the meditation practice that comes out of the Buddhist world. And when I give the teachings, I'm often teaching like general mindfulness, more secular mindfulness, but I want to draw on this one teaching because it was fun to teach, and it's also really helpful. So it is more of a Buddhist-y teaching, but I think you'll can benefit from it. And the main thing I would say is, see what's true and see, like, listen to it. It's not like a doctrinal thing that you need to believe or something, but like, see how it shows up in your own practice. I'm only interested in the teachings insofar as they impact our meditation practice. So I want to talk about wisdom and how wisdom comes through meditation. And one of the ways is a simple way to think about it is that we, our minds are so churned up most of the days and so busy and so, you know, active and distracted and living in anxiety and fear and worry and grief and anger and irritation and judging, comparing and all of that. And so when we do a mindfulness practice, we begin to calm the mind, calm, 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 and clarify the mind. And as the mind begins to settle through the simple act of what we were doing today, of just coming back into the present moment over and over, over time, as we do this practice, people begin to have insights. And so it's often called insight meditation because the insight that arises. And the insight might be, so one of the clearest examples of how this works is if you think about a glitter ball, like a snow globe, and you shake the snow globe up, that's like our mind with all the glitter flying around is totally distracted. But if you put it down and you wait and you breathe with it and you wait, the glitter will go to the bottom and you will see clearly what is inside the glitter ball. And it's kind of the same with mindfulness, that we meditate, we are mindful and present, coming back to the moment. It's almost like we're plowing the field. And then at a certain point, plants grow. And they're beautiful plants, right? Sometimes they're like, so basically it's insight arises, but it's not something that you can force and make happen. It's not like that. You can't sit there and meditate and go, okay, I need to have an insight. I want to have an insight. I want it now, right? That's not the way it works. What happens is there's more of like this plowing the field. And then when the mind is ready and ripe, it can see clearly. So the insight is more like coming from within, from our own wisdom, rather than, you know, something you read in a book, something someone tells you. That's more what I think of as knowledge. So wisdom we can think of as like from inside our bodies, and from in our deepest knowing rather than imposed from the outside. And when we meditate, there are all sorts of insights that come. And sometimes the insights are incredibly mundane, and sometimes they're really deep. And sometimes the insights are about the meditation practice itself, like, oh, my mind wanders all the time, right? And they're about our mind. Sometimes they're about our psychology. We understand things about ourselves more deeply. Sometimes they are something that comes that's like a that we're understanding our habits and our tendencies and our patterns. Because oftentimes with meditation, what I say is like, it's like a microcosm. It's a microcosm of our experience. What we do out there, we're going to see in here. So if you're a person who wants to do it perfectly, whatever it is that life brings, it might show up in your meditation that you're trying to do it perfectly all the time, you know? And so you get to see your habits and patterns, and you get to relax and release some of the tendencies around those patterns. So sometimes it's psychological, sometimes it's about, we have insights about the practice itself. And then sometimes we have insights that seem like they're more universal insights into the nature of things, of life, of reality. We might have a sense of being deeply connected with ourselves, with others, with nature, with other beings, right? There's all these beautiful insights that come. And that's one of the things I love about the practice, is that it never ends. You know, I mean, it just, yes, it can be, I think I said this recently, it can be boring. Like, meditating can be boring, right? Just going, okay, back to my breathing over and over. But the full path of being on a path of cultivating insight and compassion and wisdom and ethics and all that, that is never boring. Like, there's always more to learn. And I've been meditating now, like, since the late 80s. And I'll tell you that it doesn't grow old. It really doesn't. There's always something to learn, something new. And not that there aren't periods in my life where my practice plateaus or kind of stagnates, or I get, you know, so those ha that happens, but it's always evolving. So in the category of what we think of as of practices that are kind of more universal in, sorry, insights that are more universal in nature, there's something in that comes, I said, out of the Buddhist world, that's called the three characteristics, or the three marks of existence. And so you can listen and think for yourself, does this make sense for me? Is this true or not? So there are three. And the first, that one is that things are impermanent. The second is that things are unsatisfactory. And the third is that they are not personal or not self. So one way of saying is that they're not permanent, not perfect, and not personal. And I believe Sylvia Boorstein, a wonderful meditation teacher, used that little formulation a long time ago. So I want to go over these, and you can sense for yourself, like, does this feel like it's relevant and is it important? So the let's start with impermanence, right? Impermanence is, I mean, it's duh, it's obvious, right? Things are impermanent. We know that, but we know it really deeply. We kind of do and we don't. And the reason that I can say that is that in our lives, I mean, truly the only thing that is constant is change, right? That's the only thing we can count on, that things are going to change. But nonetheless, when we are experiencing whatever it is in life, we think it's never going to end. Or we think it's going to last forever, you know, because the change has happened, and there's all this change, whether it's the change of something, you know, the change of getting older, our bodies changing, getting sick, the change of death, the change of our children growing up, the change of our identities, the change of, you know, children moving out of the home, the change of moving into retirement, our life cycle changes, our, you know, our cells are changing, right? They say they change every 7 years. There's like a complete revision of your cells. I don't know if that's still true, or that's what I used to hear. So life is this constant movement and ch of change. And we can see this really thoroughly in our practice, right? We can see that when we meditate, that it does not stay the same from moment to moment. Now, it may feel like it does. Like, for instance, sometimes we're like, oh, the breath, it's the same thing over and over. But actually, when you get close into the breath, you see that it's made up of dozens of little tiny sensations that are changing, and there's space and softness and movement and heaviness and tight. There's everything is changing, and the thoughts, they're coming through you like they're like, we often say, clouds in the sky. Like, the thoughts come through you, and then they pass out of you. Now, some things may feel like they're more permanent, like, oh, you have a chronic health condition, my pain, it's never going to go away. But when you bring mindfulness to it, you start to notice, oh, it's not just one thing, it's made up of all these changing sensations. And a part of the reduction in pain through mindfulness practice is when we begin to see it as changing sensations as opposed to a monolithic experience that's never going to go away. So sometimes change feels great, but we forget that it's coming. And sometimes change feels terrible, and there's so much grief associated with change, right? When we lose something and someone we love. So the idea behind this practice is to acknowledge change, but not like, okay, that's changing, that's changing. Oh, that's interesting, that's changing. Although you could be kind of cognitively exploring change, it's also how we might, through our meditation practice, begin to embody change and know in our bones that change is the nature of reality, so that the next time we are in something and we're stuck and we think it's never going to change, this part of us goes, yes, this too will pass. I know it. And when something is happening that is so fantastic and we think it's never going to change, but of course at some point it may change, but we also know that too changes, and that we can savor the beautiful things of life and not try to hold on to them too tightly. So as we open to the truth of change, there's a lot of wisdom that comes, and that's like a very central piece of understanding of this concept of these three characteristics. So that's the first one, that it's things are always changing. The second is suffering, right? Is suffering, right? Or unsatisfactoriness. So this is the thing where people learn about Buddhism, for instance, and they hear that the Buddha said all life is suffering. And then they go, oh, sounds great. I'm staying far away from this religion. I don't want to have anything to do with a religion that's all like it's suffering, everybody's suffering. It's actually a very wrong interpretation, because first of all, the word is dukkha, D-U-K-K-H-A, and it's typically translated as suffering, but a better translation is it's unsatisfactoriness. And why is life unsatisfactory? Why are things unsatisfactory? And it's related to the first one of change, because we're holding on to something that is changing. So we're feeling the sense of unsatisfactoriness, and we're suffering because we're trying to stop the change from happening. And so we either, if something is pleasant, we want to make it stay and last. If something is unpleasant, we want to push it away. It's often hard to just be with things as they are. And so the most beautiful metaphor that I've heard that I shared with the students last week is imagine that you're holding onto a rope that's hanging from the ceiling, and then someone pulls it from the bottom, or it can come down, but someone pulls it from the bottom. You're holding on, and the rope is pulling past you really, really fast, and you're holding on as tightly as you possibly can. What's going to happen? What is going to happen? You're going to get rope burn. This is what happens when you hold on to things that are changing. There is this suffering, this unsatisfactoriness of trying to keep what is not keepable, that is trying to hold on to what cannot be held on to, because life is extraordinary, but life is brief, and everything that's happening in our life is this beautiful blend of the pleasant and the unpleasant, and the happiness and the joy and the sadness and the grief and the sorrow. And if we stand there trying to make it just be good and keep away the stuff that's not good, we are going to suffer. And it's okay, because humans do this, right? It's not like we're like these zombie people who are like, oh, I'm so peaceful when things are difficult, and I'm so peaceful when things are wonderful, and I just let it all come and go. Because it's not really about living a life of like disengagement. I hope that's not what you're getting from this. It's what one does is it's like holding it lightly. Like when that rope is falling from the ceiling and someone is pulling it, you are holding it lightly. You're acknowledging impermanence. It is changing. And you're acknowledging that you have preferences. You might want it to be a certain way. You might want to hold on. You might want to push it away. But the most important thing is that you do that with lightness. And you go, oh, and you do that with awareness. And it's when we are aware, we can see what we're holding on. When we're holding on tightly, there's when like the magic happens. When we go, oh, I am suffering because I'm wanting things to be this way, whatever this way is. And then you go, okay, I'm going to let go the best I can. And I'm trying to think of examples from, life. They happen every single day, all the time, where we hold on. We want the weather to be sunny and beautiful, and now it's too hot, and now it's too cold. And if you hold on to that desire for it to be a certain way, there's going to be some suffering. It's not that big of a deal if it's the weather, but when you're wanting your kid to be a certain way, when you're wanting your parents to be a certain way, why aren't they that way? They're supposed to be that way. What's wrong with them? What's wrong with me? These are all the suffering that we put on things. So this is connected to a teaching that is really powerful called the teaching of the two arrows. And that teaching is that if we can think about a difference between essentially pain and suffering. Okay. So pain is something happens in life that is inevitable or that is challenging, that right? So it's so we're touched by a painful feeling and everyone experiences it, right? Or it could be a physical thing, like it could be you hurt yourself, maybe you walked into something, you banged yourself and there's pain, or you have an emotional thing that's intense or something happens. So we're experiencing pain. We are experiencing pain in our life. There's no way around it. There is always something painful. This is called the first arrow. It's like somebody shoots you with an arrow and there is pain. But then there is a second arrow, and the second arrow is what we think of as the added suffering. The second arrow is that piece that I was talking about when we have a difficult experience and we react with resistance and craving and despair, and it's not fair, and why did this happen to me? And it should be, it's not my fault, and it's their fault, and it's, I'm never going to get better, and it's never going to end, and I'm all right. That's the whole story level we put on things, this layer. It's kind of like we get shot by an arrow, we don't have control. It really is terrible, perhaps, or it just is uncomfortable. But then we shoot ourselves with a second arrow. And that's the arrow that actually we have control over. We don't have control over the first arrow. The first arrow is going to happen, because there is suffering in life. But the second arrow is how we relate to it. And we can reduce the suffering, reduce the unsatisfactoriness by not holding on so tightly. And Shinzen Young, a teacher who's wonderful, had a he's kind of a mathematician sort of engineer guy, and he said pain plus oh, pain times resistance equals suffering, right? That's the formula. Pain times resistance equals suffering. So if we experience pain and we just go, okay, be with the pain, it's really uncomfortable, I'm here with myself, I'm mindful. Okay, what am I experiencing in my body? And then not let ourselves get lost in those stories about it. We're going to be a lot better off. And so, I mean, I've seen this a bajillion times in my life when, like, I don't know. I'm trying to think of something that happened. Like, I bang it. I don't know why I keep coming up with the banging into things. Sometimes I bang into things. I bang into something, and then I'm like, "Ow, that really hurts." And then I start with, that was so stupid. Why did you walk into that? It was right in front of you. You could have seen it, blah, blah, blah. I wonder if oh, this is going to make a bruise. It's going to look terrible, right? Do you see the difference? It could have been bang, ouch, it hurts. Oh, sweetie, I'm sorry, you're suffering, and move on. But instead, it's that whole other level of the second arrow that I shoot at myself, or that all of us do. And that's kind of a silly example, but in an example that's more, something that's happening in life that's very, very painful, a loss, or somebody you love is sick or whatever. There's the actual experience, and then all the stories and all the fear and the ruminations and the worries and the worst case scenarios and the catastrophizing and the regret and the right. All of this is happening. And so we want to use our mindfulness to notice that there is this second arrow being shot, and to kind of see if we can at least back off on it. We may not be able to stop it, we may not be able to completely control it, but at least perhaps we can be aware of it and back off on it. And someone just texted me that this is relevant to chronic pain. Absolutely. One of the reasons that mindfulness is used as a tool for working with chronic pain is because it helps people separate out the physical sensations. Well, it's both of the, it's the first thing I talked about, noticing the changing sensations. That's the impermanence. And then the second is noticing the second arrow, all the ways you create suffering by blaming yourself and worrying, and it's never going to go away. I'm not going to get better. What's wrong with me? And so on. So the more we can stay in the bare experience, the direct experience, the more we will have freedom. And this is the promise, the more we can kind of pull out the second arrow. So it's very it's a beautiful teaching and a really relevant teaching, and I hope that you take it home with you, because we can just be very direct, like, oh, I just shot a second arrow. I did it again. I did it again. Okay, I'm going to take out the arrow. Okay, so there are three. Remember, the first is impermanence, not permanent. The second is suffering or unsatisfactoriness, not perfect. And the third is, it's called not self, meaning, and the colloquial way is, it's not personal, right? Not permanent, not perfect, not personal. So this one is kind of a funny one, because it's often like it was particularly in the Buddhism. It's a very like philosophical kind of like we have, there are ways in which you can have proofs that there's not self. And you've probably heard like, oh, no self in Buddhism or something like that. I like to think of it in a much more simple way. And I think a few months ago, I gave a talk on what I call not self-centered. And that's my interpretation of it. It means it's not putting us at the center of everything. I'm not the center of the universe. And when we begin to have less of a kind of reification around me, 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 there's a lot less suffering. So rather than a philosophical idea, this not self is an invitation to loosen our identification around things. So one of the things that are happening, things are impermanent. We hold on to them. We have a lot of resistance. We don't want it to be the way. We start to suffer, and we cling to this very strong sense of me, me, me. It's all about me, me, mine. And as we start to see that things are impermanent, this is very profound. We find that, oh, right, it's just something. It's phenomena. It's things passing through me. It's not personal. Now, this is not to say, when I give this teaching, people often say, well, of course there's a self. Of course there. And yes, obviously there is a self. We are the self. We experience it. But with meditation, with our mindfulness practice, we can begin to see that we are made up of all sorts of changing things, moment after moment. There's thoughts and emotions and memories and feelings and sensations. And this is what you see when you practice. And this can be very freeing. Another way of looking at this comes from Thich Nhat Hanh, the Zen master who would teach about self being made up of non-self elements. But usually, what he would do instead would be something like, I just happen to have this on my desk. There's an apple. If you look at the apple, we think this apple is a thing, which of course it is, but it's made up of so many components. And so he'll often have you do a meditation, or he did, where you would think about the farmers and the sun and the soil and the bugs and the apple seed and the and pretty much anything you look at, he would say, you can see the presence of the entire universe in it. And so if you just look at my apple for 1 second, you can find out whether you can see the presence of the entire universe. Let me know if you did. But most importantly, it's that sense that of this third characteristic that it's not, we're not as solid entities as we appear. We're constantly changing. We're made up of multiple elements. We are, our experience is of nothing that is solid and permanent. And so you can see for yourself, like, does this make sense? Does this make sense? And what in practice, what happens when we have more understanding of the not self? And this one is harder. So I just want to say, I recommend going back to a talk I gave a few months ago called Non-Self-Centeredness, because I think it'll be clear. I'm talking about it in a different way today. But excuse me, as we practice, this insight brings freedom because we don't have to defend or resist in the same way. Compassion arises more easily when the self is less rigid. So these are the three characteristics, these three wisdom characteristics that we can all experience in our meditation practice. And like I said, it's not about a belief system. Like, I'm not saying to you, okay, this is absolutely true. You should definitely believe it. And if you don't, I don't know. I don't know what happened. But what I'm telling you, I'm inviting you into your own practice to see if these characteristics are real for you, and if they're relevant. And if so, just to play with them as in the meditation. We'll do a short meditation around that in a few minutes. So thanks for your attention around this. I see some questions were coming in and I want to get to them. And if you do, I'll take a few minutes if there are any questions, because it's sort of like complex what I've been teaching. So someone was giving an example of, she said, my wonderful cat vet has to close her practice and it's hard to accept. Okay, so this is an example in a way of the three characteristics, or some of them, right? Like, it's something that you're really attached to, that you love, who's been wonderful for you, it sounds like, and for your cat. And there's change. They're closing their practice. This happens all the time, right? And then what happens is we go, no, I don't want it to change. I want it to stay the same. And then if we do that, I guarantee a lot of suffering. And it's not like you might not do that for a little while, but use your practice to notice the grief, be with it. Oh, it was such a great situation. I loved her so much. She was so, and feel the love and the connection, and also the tuning into the changing nature of life, that things are passing, things are changing, can be really helpful, because then we kind of go, okay, we get aligned with reality and we go, you know what? That's just going to happen. People are going to close their practice and move in and move on with their life. And what can I do next? Finding a good vet as well, you know. I'm wondering if I should let go of stability in the midst of changing. You know, I'm not quite sure I understand the question. If you would either come on screen or explain it a little more. Someone asks, what are these again? Three wisdom characteristics of mindfulness, three characteristics of reality, one can say, that one perceives with mindfulness. So one, with mindfulness, we began to see these characteristics present throughout our life. Someone asked me, why did I say rigid? And I have no memory of why I said rigid. If anyone remembers that, I'm happy. I'm very happy to answer that if I knew what it was. Maybe Serena, can you find that the talk on non-self-centeredness and let them know, because someone was asking. Selfless. Oh, I think maybe I was saying we hold on rigidly to our sense of self. Me, me, me. I'm so important. I'm the center of things. But as we begin to see the changing nature of all the things that make us up, and the interdependent nature of us and all things, we don't have to hold on so tightly. And when we hold on less tightly, there's often more ease, more peace, more compassion for ourselves and others. And I said, so here it says, you said compassion is more elusive when we're rigid. I think I just explained that. Well, someone was mentioning, oh, Serena linked the talk. Someone was mentioning, I think, the Four Agreements. I have seen that book, but I think there's something about don't take yourself too personally, right? Okay. Actions are okay. Gina, I'm not sure w what you're saying here. Okay. Oh, others' actions and words are projections of their own reality, not reflections of you. By not taking these things personally, you become immune to needless suffering. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. There's so many ways in which our world and our self-view gets constructed by what other people think of us and other people say of us. Say towards us and about us. And if we can not get so take them so personally, we're not going to suffer as much. Now, that's not easy to do, especially if it's like a parent, a spouse, someone you really love or care for, right? But nonetheless, it's something you can aspire towards. This is very useful to help me better understand a family member who struggles with change. And it also helps me to deal with my frustration with his opposition to change. Yeah, when we hold these characteristics in mind, we can start to see the way we're suffering and we can see the way other people are suffering. And we're not going to like say to them, oh, by the way, if you really understood change, you wouldn't suffer so much. That wouldn't be a good idea. But we can have compassion towards them. We can model different behavior. So this is you're now that I've said these three things to you, you're going to start at least the first two. You're probably going to start seeing them in your life in different ways, like how you shot the third arrow, how your spouse shot the, I mean, third, second arrow. Now there's seven arrows, 10 arrows. No, you'll see yourself shooting an arrow at yourself. You'll see other people shooting the second arrow at themselves, and you'll start to maybe notice, like, oh, there are ways out. Someone wrote, "Your meditation on the apple reminds me of the Carl Sagan quote, 'If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.'" That's beautiful. I've never heard that. Thank you. I did not know what today's lesson was about. During mindfulness practice, I felt a sense of clarity focusing on the breath. This is the insight. Beautiful. Yeah. In some ways, the practice speaks for itself. Like, if I never gave you all these lectures about things, you would. Maybe, I don't know, that you might encounter this wisdom on your own and just like I said, the practice can speak for itself. Allegra wrote, "Now I have to figure out how to weave this into an answer when the job interviewer asks, how do you respond to change?" Good luck on that. Yeah. So, oh, what if someone shoots a second arrow at you? Yeah, good question. That does happen. That absolutely happens. So maybe that's the third arrow, right? So there's the one, the actual one, whatever the thing is, the difficulty is, then the one you blame yourself. And then there could be a third arrow coming at you with somebody going, "You jerk, why did you let that happen? If you hadn't done that, da, da, da," right? So I think our job is really to pull out that third arrow, and it's kind of like what someone is saying, not take on what other people say about us. But that's easier said than done, especially if it's from parents and so on. The key is mindfulness. The key is mindfulness is and compassion for yourself. Like, okay, someone's coming at me with all their judgments and blames and stories, and it's just their story, and I don't have to take it on. It's like someone is handing you a hot coal and they're burning up, but you don't have to accept it. Easier said than done, but possible. So it gets more complex with other people, but these are some tools for working with it. So I'm going to just take a few minutes to do a little meditation about these three characteristics, and then I'm going to end a bit early because I have to go pick up my daughter from school. But let's just settle back into our meditation. We're mostly going to do a meditation about the first one, about the impermanence. So, taking a moment or two to reconnect with yourself, feeling your body, breath. And let's find your home base, your anchor, just for the sake of this meditation right now. So maybe it's the breath in your abdomen, chest, or nose. Yeah, if possible, do the breath, unless that really doesn't work for you, but just something really kind of simple. Staying with your breath just to keep you grounded. But it might be your feet on the floor, changing sensations and hands. Might be sound. So just feeling the stability. But the first thing I want you to notice with your breath is that your breath is changing. If you're noticing your body breathing, that breath, one breath is not like another breath. Superficially, it appears that way, but find out for yourself. Is it changing? Now let's turn our attention to the sounds. Everybody do that because this one is pretty obvious. See if you can notice the sound that sounds are changing moment after moment, including the sound of my voice that keeps changing. So as we listen to the sounds with our awareness, there's one sound and then the next sound, the next sound. Now, there might be something like in the room you're in that feels like it's constant, but it too has little minute changes in it. So let's listen to the changes in sound. And now shift your attention into your body. You might notice there's sensations. So just kind of tuning in and just noticing what are the most obvious sensations for you. And are those sensations staying the same or are they changing? There might be like tingling and itching and burning and, expansion, contraction, warmth, coolness, heaviness, hardness, softness. You might notice that your attention goes from one sensation to another sensation to another sensation. Just be really curious about the process, the way that change is happening. And even if you have strong physical pain or even some pain right now, if you were to really pay attention to it, is it staying the same or is it changing? And if you do have any physical pain, is there a story you're telling yourself? Is there a second arrow about that pain? Just to notice, not to get mad at yourself and judge yourself for judging. Let's move into the realm of our emotions. Notice how you're feeling. Now, you might not be feeling anything in particular, but if you are, what do you notice? Maybe your heart is heavy, or you're anxious, or you're irritated. Where do you feel these in your body? And is it staying the same, or is it changing? And guess what? Your awareness of it is changing a lot, right? If you notice it in one place, then you notice it again, and you notice it again. And is there a second arrow connected to the emotion or the absence of emotion? Bringing some kindness to yourself, because this one could be harder. How about thoughts? So it's harder to see, but can you recognize your thoughts coming and going? This one actually is, if you can get it, there's a lot of change because it's just changing dramatically all the time. And now, putting it all together, if you were to notice your whole experience of the breath and the sounds and the sensations and emotions and thoughts, and then other things too, maybe there's images, mind states, moods. If you were to notice all of it at once, can you experience the changing nature of it? Do you notice if you have a second arrow or you're creating suffering through some kind of resistance to your experience? You may not be, you may just be like curious and interested, but maybe there's some resistance. I like this. I don't like this. I want this to last. Notice if it's there's some element of unsatisfactoriness. And finally, noticing if it's personal. Who's in charge? Who's running the show? Is there someone in charge? Can you find that self? And you may say, yes, I can, but just to notice. Are we one solid thing? Are we made up of constantly changing conditions, aspects of self? In every moment, okay, and finally, I just invite you to offer yourself some kindness because you may have had a little glimpse of, oh, I think I get what she's talking about, or you might not have, or I don't know what happened, where you are with it. So I just want best medicine is often kindness. So just bringing a little kindness to yourself for exactly where you are. And then when you're ready, you can open your eyes or end the meditation. Okay. Nice to practice this with you. I'm going to take like 2 more minutes if you want to. I'm just curious what happened when you did that meditation, just to pop things in the chat if you want to, and then we'll close in a couple of minutes. Someone wrote, I had the insight that as all of these things are changing, each moment is completely unique and it will never be exactly the same again. So each is important. That's beautiful and really powerful. because there's the kind of like the negative side and the avoidance side. But when we see life for the like magical beauty it is, it's like we want to savor life and enjoy. And you said it even better than I'm saying it right now. So thank you for that. People like the arrows. I meditated with a home full of young kids. The sounds changed a lot, but it was fun to notice how they change. I found that behind every thought of resistance, there is a contraction. Yeah, that's really great noticing. I think I was able to see the subtle way in the way I thought I was fully myself, but not wholly. Cool. That's great. Fantastic. Interesting to see even sounds change. Yeah. So thank you so much for your attention. I'm sorry I had to condense today, but I got to get my kid. And for everybody's lovely observations and questions, and I just encourage you to keep exploring this as you meditate. And one thing to say is, you can just do your regular practice if you have a daily practice, and then every now and then be like, oh, I'm going to look at change. I'm going to notice change, or I'm going to notice the resistance, or notice an arrow, or you can really bring it into your life. Okay. All right, everybody. So good to be with you. Thanks so much, and I think I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to the UCLA Mindful Weekly Lecture. For more information about our classes, workshops, and retreats, please visit uclahealth.org/UCLA Mindful. Join us each week for a new session on mindfulness.